largely Italians drive wonderfully. I was astonished driving downtown Milan and everything. They don't, you know, blinkers and lanes or suggestions, but everybody just avoids everybody. And it's actually, you know, there's not a lot of beeping or horns or no expletives. It's just, Italy was a wonderful country to drive in other than that one experience with the trucks. Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we talk the French and Italian Rivieras.
Welcome, my friend.
Yeah, I just didn't have like a good segue into saying hello to you.
I know. What happened? I think you just must be exhausted from all the European travel.
Well, we did take a little bit of a break. We sort of, you know, front loaded our June recordings and so we did have a little bit of a break. And so now we're a little bit rusty as we're trying to get back to this.
That's true. We're getting back. We've done a little bit of a hiatus, I guess. This is our summer hiatus.
And I think we've done this last year as well. I mean, we just sort of, you just need a couple of weeks off to sort of freshen up the ideas, refresh the ideas, think a little bit more creatively. We're going to try to do something a little bit different with this episode. And we've got some more innovative things to come, I think, in some of the episodes down the line, right?
Always innovating.
Yeah. And here we are, we're both coming off trips. I think this one, I hate to take the lion's share of the time, but I think this is one, at least for me, this was a pretty milestone-y.
You were gone for a long time. And I should know, I dropped you off and picked you up from the airport.
That was a big deal. The parking for an 18-day trip, the logistics for all that. I mean, that is not insignificant. That was a very incredible thing that you did, and we really appreciate it, especially considering there were four of us traveling, car seat, luggage, all that other stuff. And you made time in your day, both, you know, on the way out and the way back.
Well, you know, I have this kind of mantra around picking people up from the airport. I like to do it. You know, it's actually one of my favorite things to do because people who know me probably hear this, me say this all the time. It's an asymmetric good. You know, it's where the benefit to the person who I'm picking up is usually 10 times worth 10 times more than it is trouble for me just, you know, taking them to the airport.
It might be 100 times.
Yeah.
When you think about for this trip, because it was a family trip, we had we had the mother-in-law with, who is a little mobility challenged, much as with your folks. It's just harder to walk long distances. And so being able to get dropped off right at the terminal.
Door-to-door service. Everybody, you know, who listens to this are probably very multiplier obsessed. So for me, it's the benefit or good multiplier, right? To be able to do something for someone. It's, again, that 100, it's 100x, right? 100x.
100x. And I will be paying you back some way or another for the rest of my life.
Oh no, it's fine. It's fine. But I like banking those 100x friend points. But you know, speaking of friend points, you know, let's talk about some of this trip because this is a long trip, 18 days, right? Let's talk about some of these numbers. This is a pretty impressive number of what? Properties, points, etc. It's all of the above, right?
It really is. And this was one of those kind of once in a lifetime trips. We go down this path of saying, oh, so many once in a lifetime trips, you know, Maldives, all that other stuff.
You know, that might have to be a new drinking game, the once in a lifetime trip.
It might need to be. I mean, the miles and points allow us to do a lot of this stuff, far more than we should. But this one factored in a little bit more close to heart because so my wife's got an aunt that lives in Mujan, which is about 20 minutes from Cannes. My mother-in-law had wanted to get back out to the French Riviera to see her sister and just to kind of go through old haunts that they had seen many years ago when she had visited her sister in previous trips. And so this was a big deal for the mother-in-law. It was a big deal for the rest of the family because we've only got to see my wife's aunt a short number of times, just a couple times.
So I guess fair to say this is a pretty big family trip. You know, there's a huge family focus on this last trip.
Absolute family focus on this trip. And so we had that time to spend with the aunt, but we also, you know, wanted to see the area because I had never been and my wife had wanted to share a lot of the stuff that she had seen when she was a teenager with me and with our daughter. And then we had to figure out how the heck we were getting home. And so we added the Italian Riviera part to it and sort of did that little bit of a hockey stick up to Milan. Ultimately, we had five hotels. They were all but one were Hyatts. There was one that was an Accor and will forever reign in the worst five hotels that we've ever stayed at.
Oh, it's joining the annals of your most, what is it, the lowest hotels you've ever stayed in, right? Well, what would that be, your worst five list?
It is definitely in the worst five list at this time. And it was, if it had not been a safe hotel, it would have been in the like bottom two. But it's in the bottom five, and we don't really keep that list terribly up to date because we don't really often get something that badly. But yes, get to that in a moment. We did do something really different for us. We did two apartments, and we also drove. My wife's aunt let us drive her. She had a second car that she graciously let us borrow for about a week, and that was standard. My wife knows how to drive standard better than I do. She, being an absolute saint, drove for the first week. If push came to shove, I could have gotten behind the wheel and I probably would have done fine. But I ate my ego and I said, you know what? When she got behind the wheel, it just clicked. Like, have you ever seen someone like they haven't done something? It's like getting on a bike.
It's riding a bicycle, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you just see, boom, they just know exactly what they're doing. I mean, she got into this car, she's shifting it, like she was at a stoplight and she was just working through the shifts with her eyes closed. She wasn't even looking at the shifter. And I was like, you know what? You're just going to drive this. I'm totally good. And then I'll put in my time when we get a rental later on in the trip. And let's see, the last thing two other pieces by the numbers before I get into how much this actually cost.
That's what everyone's waiting for, you know.
And we don't really talk about it that much, right? We don't talk about that part much, but we'll get there.
I think we do. I mean, we kind of tell you a little bit about the redemption side on these podcasts. So I think we're usually pretty open about these things.
I don't usually track it as closely as I probably should. But yeah, so probably the biggest thing was the first night away from our daughter. Because we had my wife's aunt and her mother, our daughter stayed with them. And then they stayed with them in a little town called Fraiju, which is about 20, 30 minutes from Cannes in the south of France. And we flew from Nice, France, to Milan, Italy, for an overnight at the Park Hyatt. We picked up a rental car, which we ended up driving back to be able to have that rental car to get us ultimately to Milan for a flight out. And so our first night away from our daughter, we literally went to another country.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you had two grand people. So to babysit, so probably as an ideal situation as you would think, although it does sound more dramatic when you say you left the country, you left your daughter in another country.
yeah, I don't know. It sounded good when I said it in my head. I mean, effectively, we were really only about 2.5 hours away by car because if something happened, they would have been able to drive our way. We would have been able to drive their way and, you know, really only 2.5 hours away, but it sounds more dramatic being, you know, a different country. And then because it was so hot and because the gelato was just so incredibly good, I think we got very near 50 cups of gelato or ice cream or cones of gelato in our 18 days.
Too bad those punch cards don't, you know, go over borders or anything. You know, you think you'd have a couple free gelatos by that point.
Oh my God. I wish we did. We found some really good gelato places though. They were pretty good.
What was the best flavor? Like what was the resounding favorite flavor?
You know, our daughter loves strawberry and that was absolutely amazing. There were a few hot days and my wife got a lemon chiffon and it was just absolutely perfect for the heat. And then I just happened to go in, there was a weird caramel flavor and it was only like the one day we were in Milan. We were in Milan multiple days, but like only one day we went to this non-chain gelato place recommended by the Hyatt-centric staff. And it was just this like simply fantastic caramel. And it was like an amaretto caramel. And it was just, I was so disappointed when they didn't have it the next day. Like we went back the next 2 days and both days they didn't have it. And I was just heartbroken because I was like, this is the best I've had.
Yeah, it's like the Costco of gelatos, huh? You better get it that day and it may not be there the next, huh?
We're going to go with that. Yeah.
I'm with you though. I think fruit flavored gelato, that's the way to go in the summertime.
Oh yeah. It's just so refreshing.
Well, we've got some interesting numbers as far as what your hotels, your apartments, your rental cars, your number of gelatos eaten. Any other interesting numbers you want to go over?
Well, let's go over the travel numbers, right? So this trip was just under 1 million miles. It was 955,000 miles. We burned 244,000 miles, Asia miles, to fly British Airways from Washington Dulles outside of DC via London. We were supposed to go to Nice, ended up landing in Marseille. We'll talk about that later.
that's an interesting one. You chose Asia miles, huh? I don't think I knew that. I didn't think I would have expected that, actually.
Well, so that's actually because if you remember last year, you were going to be with us, had booked going to, I believe we were going to fly to ARN. So what's that, Stockholm?
Oh, to Stockholm? Okay.
Yeah, we were originally going to fly to Stockholm in August of 2 years ago.
I do and recall instead, that we were going to try to do a Finnair flight. I do remember that.
Yeah, and so I had those left over from that because instead you invited us on the Voyager of the Seas and that cruise out of Copenhagen. And so I had to put those Asia miles to use, otherwise they were going to expire.
They're going to expire.
As it was, I had to fight like heck for them. So once we were able to negotiate, and I don't know if we extended them or whatever, we booked it last year. And the second they were back in my account, I was like, that's it. We're booking something. We're just going to do it. And then I just figured out the rest of the trip from there. Then we ended up burning 280,000 Aeroplan miles to fly from Milan via Zurich back home to Dulles. And we booked, I'm 90% sure that this number is right, but we used about 265,000 Hyatt points for the Hyatt hotels. In some cases, we had two rooms per night. And we also were able to do the family rate in Milan. So instead of spending I think it's 20,000 per room, we spent 20,000 for one room. And then I think I paid $167 or so for the second room, kind of leveraging that family rate that Joe Chung had shared with us on the Asia Pacific episode that he graciously joined us for some months ago from his trip last year. The apartments were different, and I'm not entirely sure whether or not it was better or worse. The experience, I think, worked out better because the amount of space, but we spent about $1,967 on apartments. We had one apartment for 5 days in a place called Fréjus, which is near Saint-Raphaël, about an hour from Saint-Tropez and about a half hour from Cannes in the French Riviera. That apartment, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. And then the second apartment in Genoa was just three nights through Marriott Villa Homes and Villas. And the two experiences were just starkly different, but we pushed ourselves in our comfort zone.
Yeah, how are they starkly different? I mean, I'm sorry to maybe skip ahead, but just kind of rather than bounce around, what caused the difference?
Well, so the Fréjus apartment, so first of all, I probably should have done a little bit better research in Saint-Raphaël and Fréjus. It felt very much like an Ocean City type experience. And uh-huh. When I say that, I mean, it was very touristy, but we were like the only English speakers. It was like the place that the French go for their summer vacations.
So basically like a condo that you'd rent in Ocean City, except you put it in the French Riviera.
Yeah, and it was good. It was luxury, I'll say. It had its own parking spot. We had outdoor area, a little outdoor deck. It was the first floor of this apartment or condo complex. Multiple bedrooms, but it was very European. It was very French. It was very tight. There was at least one time where I actually knocked my head on the wall trying to go into the water closet because the water closet was about 2 inches wider than the actual toilet.
Wow.
It was walking distance to the beach, though. It was less than a block away from the beach, which was absolutely amazing. We were about a half mile away from a boulangerie, so I'd let my wife sleep. My daughter and I would walk down, or I'd put her in a stroller. We'd walk down to the boulangerie, get breakfast. If my wife didn't want to sleep, then we'd all walk down. Then we'd just sit at the beach and have our croissants.
So it sounds like, you know, it was great because you got to live like the French live. And it was horrible because you got to live like the French live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think I think it was probably a little bit more location based that was less than stellar, just because it was, again, very, very touristy. It was actually probably one of the more expensive. I think we found the prices to be more in Fréjus and Saint-Raphaël than we did in Cannes and Nice. And then the other apartment was in Genoa, or Genova, as the Italians, I believe, call it. That was good. It was like third or fourth floor. We had a dedicated parking space that required only 5K turns to get into and out of, and one spotter. There was a little bit of a bad joys of experience.
The joys of parking in Europe, right?
Oh yes, and it was a parking garage, no less. So you had the bat cave experience as well.
You didn't get a Fiat 500 or something, you know, or something that turns on a dime.
Well, we needed room because we had four people.
Oh, that's right.
And
your needs were a little bit more than that.
Yeah, and oh my gosh, that's a story I didn't actually include. We'll include that in Goose and Gaffs at the end, or whenever we want to get to that. But the Skoda had, shall we say, a water problem.
Oh, okay. Car troubles too. Nice. It's starting to sound like Clark Griswold and National Lampoon's here a little bit.
There were some shades of that. but to finish about the Genoa apartment, it felt true luxury. Proper wine glasses, nice open space. The differences we found between the two apartments, the one in France had a lot of stuff. It was very IKEA-y, right? Like it had a lot of things that our daughter could pull down and potentially break or otherwise make us really nervous. It had a lot of very sharp corners that also made us nervous. In Genoa, the Marriott property, the Marriott Homes and Villa, this is like a Visit Italy or something like that, kind of like a larger company that owns a bunch of these. It was brand new. They had not as much of the kind of adornment. And as a result, it felt just like a much more safer space for our family.
I guess in this case, the minimalist decorating style is more to your fancy when doing your European travels, I guess, instead of the kitschy French Riviera style.
Yeah. I mean, and again, they still had like the nice wine glasses and stuff. It's just, you know, it was not a lot of stuff below 3 feet.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, it's interesting that there is. I guess you're noticing an apparent difference from the two different modes of, I guess, rental. You know, was the other an Airbnb or like what platform was the one in France?
Booking.com.
Oh, it was Booking.com.
I literally did things that are completely out of my comfort zone on this one.
I was going to say, like, of all the places, Booking.com. I mean, that's just it's so random.
Well, so I looked at Vacasa. Vacasa doesn't do Europe, so far as I could tell. We have RCI, and I couldn't find anything there. So originally, when this trip was being planned, up until about 6 months out, the feeling was that my wife's aunt might have had a friend that might have had an open apartment that might have been available for us to rent and utilize. And that sort of went off the table about 6 months prior. And so then we started to scramble with, okay, when can we get into hotels? When can we not get into hotels? Hyatt Regency's 25 or 30,000. The Hotel Martinez in Cannes is 40 or 45,000 Hyatt points. And so suddenly an 18 day trip becomes unaffordable if you're spending 30,000 to 40,000 points per night for a hotel. And so we just had to pivot, and that's kind of in all candor that made it a lot more fun. I mean, there were some downsides, but it definitely made this much more memorable.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm not going to go ahead and criticize, you know, the way you did it, because, you know, I completely agree. I think if you had to spend all 18 nights in, you know, category, what, 5, 6 hotels, 7 hotels, you know, on the Hyatt side, that does start getting pretty cost prohibitive. So finding alternatives, I think, makes a lot of sense and definitely seems to be the right way to do it. I mean, I'd say splurge to enjoy some of those high category offerings. So you can have a taste, but, you know, there's no reason why you need to be there for a whole week.
Yeah. And I have to say, after 5 days in an apartment, we did 3 days in the apartment, moved to the Park Hyatt Milan for that one night, leaving the family back. And then we back for another night, and then we moved to the Hotel Martinez. And I have to tell you, I didn't realize how much I appreciated both the Park Hyatt Milan and the Hotel Martinez in Cannes. We got in there and we were just like, oh my God, this is the luxury we're used to. This is the luxury that we have underappreciated for so long. We had a newfound appreciation for the bedding, the service. They bring the bags up. They didn't have to huff everything back and forth to the car. Those small little things that, like, candidly, we were taking it for granted over the course of our travels. And so now we have a healthy appreciation for it again.
Well, you know, and quite honestly, you know, sometimes that's a good thing because, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Sometimes the appreciation comes after the lack of, right? And like you said, you know, I think you get accustomed to certain things when you stay at, like, you know, the high level hotels and of course, you know, not experiencing them and forgetting, like, oh yeah, where's the guy that's taking my bag? Where are the, you know, 1,000 thread linens? You know, where are all these, you know, fancy things? And you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I'm in an Airbnb or I'm in a booking.com rental.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Would we do it again? I think we would in the right circumstance. But but yeah, I think we like our housekeeping. our room service. Well, not room service, but our housekeeping.
You like your room serviced. Maybe not room service, but you like daily housekeeping.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
This trip, I guess, was interesting, I guess, from a couple of perspectives for you. I mean, it's obviously another big family trip. It's one where, you know, you did bring the mother-in-law, so it's one extra body than maybe what you've done in the past, right? And that complicated things, I imagine, just a tad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced that three seats is hard. Two seats, I was like, you know what? You can do two seats anytime, right? The first 2 years of my daughter's life, I was like, you know what? We can find two seats. We're good. I mean, that's super easy. Do it last minute, all that other stuff. Three seats, it gets harder. We're in a situation right now where we're trying to find three seats home for a trip in the fall, and we're starting to look for next year. I mean, just three seats to try to get down to Florida sometimes is hard. But when you add that fourth seat, it's sort of like the difference between trying to race a 100-yard dash. We're getting into the Olympics, right? So whatever that 100-yard dash is versus doing a triathlon.
Well, I mean, we have pretty geeky, you know, listeners. Maybe we could just say it's the difference between going exponential and going factorial.
We're going to go with that. We are going to go with that. We are going with that. Yeah. So finding that fourth seat, I was really surprised at how hard that was. And I know that the family gave me a little bit of pushback over a number of times, both during the trip and prior to the trip, about that British Airways and I think we had a 4 or 6 hour connection in British Airways. There were a lot of people unhappy about that. And I could not do anything better about it. The Asia Miles. Oh,
basically, you know, flying BA across the Atlantic. Was this the older product or was this the Club Suites?
No, this was on the A380. This is the older product. This is just, I mean, I would not recommend it.
Yeah.
Literally, this was, we had Asia Miles that were going to expire. I was going to get them used one way or another. And I paid for it with the happiness of the family on the way out. The goodness is once they saw that beautiful blue water on the of the Mediterranean, they forgot all about it. we just had to go through the pain to get to Saturday morning.
Yeah, definitely one of the less, I guess, attractive options to go over the Atlantic these days, you know, is that British Airways seat. You know, it's that traditional yin yang seat where you get a lovely view of your seatmate, and especially awkward if you don't actually know who they are with takeoff and landing, right? Relatively dense product over the Atlantic.
Yeah, exactly. And so for example, we got to the airport for departure, and my mother-in-law wanted simple. I was like, okay, so we can get a nice sit-down meal at the Chase Sapphire Lounge, and then we can somehow figure out whether we can get the wheelchair to go from one end of the terminal to the other. She's like, no, just send me to the British Airways terminal. You guys can do what you want and just meet me there. Well, we do that, And we're sitting down having a nice meal at the Chase Fire Lounge, and we get a text of saying, "Hey, you guys coming anytime soon?" And we're sort of like, we're like,
I could have guessed that this is where this was going.
Yeah. And I guess I should have anticipated that.
Yeah, I would say don't split up in these type of situations, because you know they just you just end up giving yourself more anxiety than you really need.
Yeah, and I think the problem for us was this is the first overseas trip in a long time that we could 5-6 weeks, and the prior one we didn't get the chance to do lounge hopping either, or much lounge hopping, and so we wanted to try to go. Because we were going out of British Airways, we were like, oh, we can just, you know, stop into this lounge. We can get a glass of Tattinger at the Air France lounge. And ultimately, we ended up doing the Chase Sapphire Lounge, got our burgers. They have a great kids chicken tender meal that our daughter just loves. And then we just kind of hightailed it over to the British Airways lounge, walking the entire other end of the
the entire length of Dulles Airport.
Yeah, exactly. And it worked out well. And we came to find that they have a plated menu that they'll bring out to you. And so we were able to get my mother-in-law fish and chips, which she absolutely loves.
And that's pretty common, right, for like the supper kind of service that they offer in the lounges for the people who are flying transatlantic business.
Yes and no. I mean, so Virgin, the Chase Lounge, and now British Airways do that. I don't think British Airways used to do that, like before the pandemic. And I haven't been in there since I think you and I and many other, a handful of others were in that lounge for the Cathay Pacific nonstop to Hong Kong in like, what, 2018?
When I recall, because, you know, I have actually left on British Airways, if in business class or first class, I think they do offer a slightly different service for their own customers. That they don't offer it for the partners, obviously, but you know, for their own customers, they typically have some kind of in-lounge dining. And it might just be a light buffet or something like that, but something slightly different than just the standard lounge offering, you know, especially on those evening transatlantic flights. At least that's been my experience.
And they did have the buffet, but they actually had a menu that you could order, which was very nice. And we'll be flying them in October, so I'm excited to try that menu out. But yeah, that splitting up, I thought it was a good idea. It was not a good idea.
You know, this is the thing is, you know, when you have, and I'm going to speak for my mother, who is not that different in age, I think, than your mother-in-law, and also has mobility problems. They will say lots of things like, oh, don't bother, you know, oh, this, that, or the other thing, but that don't believe them. They're lying through their teeth.
Touche. Yeah. Well, and it made an interesting experience in the British Airways lounge, right? So yes. I completely forgot that the last trip that we took her on, my mother-in-law on, was also through London Heathrow, except that one was on United, and we ended up going from United to a taxi. Well, this time it was apparently not as bad as the last time, but she had all that memory in her mind. And apparently it's very common for like the wheelchair pushers to like stop at random stopping points, talk story, all this other stuff. So by the time she made it to the lounge, which was after we made it to the lounge, well after we made it to the lounge, she was not in the best of moods. And she was like, I should have just stayed at the remote gate area, because I think we came into C gates. And we came all the way back to A gates to go to the lounge, because you had to go through whatever security and all that other stuff at Heathrow flying into British Airways. And so I had been doing my research, and I was like, but we're going out of these gates. And she's like, if you say so. And so it wasn't until like the guy comes and tells her, hey, it's time to go. And then we see her on the plane, and she's like, you're right. It was really a good idea to go to that lounge. I appreciated having a little bit of bite to eat. But I mean, those little things kind of change the experience. And like, I need to figure out how to do those better, because I don't think this is going to be, you know, I know that there's going to be a Sydney trip or an Australia trip coming up, and I got to figure out how can we do this family travel thing better. And I apologize if we spend a little bit more time on this than we probably wanted to, but I mean, I think multi-generational travel is not something that, that we talk enough about.
Well, you know, and people have, like you said, people have different needs, and it gets complicated. Like, interestingly enough, you know, we tend to do multi-generational travel a lot, but it's usually cruise ship related, and that has a lot of things, I guess, that kind of help buffer some of those friction points. That helps quite a bit, at least when you're on a cruise ship. But yeah, the actual transportation part, I mean, when you're having to deal with the old and the young and the in between, it does complicate the logistics quite a bit.
Well, and it's easier with a cruise ship to stay together. In some cases, like we tried in the beginning, we tried to stay together, not this trip, but in previous trips, we tried to stay together, and the elevators just aren't big enough for 5-6 people in luggage.
Oh, you're right. Yep. Especially in Europe.
Yeah. And so it really does complicate things.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I figured it out yet. And sometimes the hardest part is you have, you know, certain people who have opinions, and sometimes there's not the right opinions. Some people are being a little bit too optimistic about, oh, I don't need a wheelchair. Yes, you do. And that doesn't help either. So I think it's the challenge you're experiencing is probably something that most families who happen to, you know, need to cater to multiple generations at the same time, especially in air travel. You know, I mean, you're just lucky that also, I mean, you're doing it in premium class. I mean, it'd be far worse if you were in economy or some other class.
Oh, that's so true. That's so true. So just to close out a little bit on our family travel topic, if I may, through the course of the trip, we were reminded about how much we enjoy finding little play yards or play parks or kids parks. And so in the course of the trip, we have created a Google Maps shared, I don't know, a shared list. We'll include the link in the show notes. But essentially, what we found is, you know, there's a number of different play parks where some are better than others. I think we joked about it on the Madrid podcast episode, where we found this one nice little play yard area where our daughter could play in this nicely, you know, kind of fenced in area, go on slides and everything. And we just sat at a cafe and enjoyed our gin and tonics while she played. And it occurred to me that maybe sharing those types of things might be helpful. And so we've created this. We've added a number of sites across this trip, as well as some of the previous trips that we've done. And as I said, we'll have that in the show notes for anybody else that wants to contribute. I think those are some things that Europe does really well, and it's easy to forget about them. So kind of sharing that information is important. Funny little story, in Nice, we found this one play park, big park. I mean, it must have been like 2-3 blocks long. And they had these little trampolines. And our daughter, she's never really jumped. It doesn't even occur to me on some of these things. And so she steps on the trampoline and she feels it. And then she's like kind of bouncing. And no joke, the first 2 or 3 days after we got home, she is jumping all over the house and still is jumping all over the house. She started learning that she could jump.
For better or worse, right?
Exactly. But she was like, she started jumping on that trampoline and she's been jumping ever since. But like, you know, it's those small little things. And it's like, hey, I will never forget that play play park or kids park because of that experience.
I mean, I think you bring up an interesting point, because I think, and we may have already touched on this during the Madrid episode as well, but you know, parents in Europe have such a different culture, right, in terms of how they deal with kids and how they deal with play, right? And if anything, you know, it feels like European kids are given far more leeway. You know, I think that the kind of the helicopter parenting, you know, regime or whatever, or method is far more American than you're going to find in Europe. At least that seems to be the general case. And so, you know, in some cases, yeah, going to some of these play parks is very much a tourist experience, because you are experiencing something that's very unique, regional, and specific to Europe, where clearly like something like a trampoline in a park would probably not make it in America for the legal reasons alone. So
yeah. And we try to embrace that stuff. So we caught up with friends that live in Zurich, and come to find out that Zurich Airport has a B gates sky deck. So I think it opens at like 10 a.m. and you've got to go through security and stuff. They don't really want you to take big luggage or anything. We checked our bags and we don't normally check our bags, but we really wanted to go to this place.
So wait, so just to clarify, is this B-Gates Skydeck, is it for everybody? Is it only for passengers, or is it for people who are coming to visit for the day?
Anybody. I don't believe they actually require a boarding pass. Our friends just came in from their home. They live in Zurich, and they just came in for the day. So you're over the gates. You can see the planes boarding. You're like, if you're over a particular gate, they even have a monitor that shows you where that flight is going, the timing, et cetera. They have swings. They have trampolines. They have other kids' experiences. They also told, although we didn't have the time to do it, they have apparently another sky deck on the E-gates, which is where like the international stuff, the non-Schengen stuff goes. That's where we ultimately flew out of. And apparently they have a bus that takes you between the two. And what they'll do is they'll occasionally stop on the tarmac. So you can, like when a plane's landing or something. So you get a really, really unique view. I've only been on the tarmac like a handful of times. And so if I get a long layover in Zurich, that's something I'm going to put on my list.
You know, I don't think it's unique to Zurich. I mean, I think when you look at these, like, you know, in the U.S. we're used to plane spotting areas to be, you know, in parks or In-N-Out Burger or, you know, some random grassy knoll somewhere. But, you know, in other parts of the world, you know, this is not all that uncommon to have these kind of public sky deck areas for plane viewing that are actually accessible to the non-flying public. Because, you know, some people do find it interesting just to head to the airport and do a little bit of plane spotting. And I know in particular, I remember going to Narita. And I think Narita, I think maybe it's Terminal 1, has a lovely area with shops and a nice plane spotting deck that's fully accessible to people who are not ticketed passengers. And so I feel that this is actually a lot more common in certain parts of the world than apparently in Zurich and places like Tokyo, but maybe just a little bit foreign to us in America, where, you know, they're not, I guess these days there just aren't as many people that are interested in heading to the airport and doing plane spotting unless you're actually traveling.
I think it's the security aspect that kind of limits some of that in the U.S.
Yeah, I would agree. But, you know, at the same time, there's probably ways that the airport authorities can figure it out. I mean, they clearly have in Switzerland and in Japan. But then again, you're right. You know, they have very different security regimes. And, you know, they have different populaces with different threats and different types of things that they're trying to counter. So, you know, I guess you can't say that every country deals with things in the same way.
So true. So true. So where do we want to jump from here?
Probably one of the things that I'd love to hear about is you went to two countries with which are actually quite known for their cuisine. I'd love to hear about some of your dining experiences.
So the dining experiences wasn't where we, I think, did the best. I hate to admit it. I mean, I think we had a lot of pizza. I think we had some fantastic gelato. Yeah, the gelato. We arrived in Nice, I think, early Saturday morning, the 14th of June. And I say that because the 15th of June was the Ironman triathlon. And so we had a kind of a unique experience. My wife had seen the Ironman in Kona, Hawaii. And she always spoke very, very highly of it and was just like, this is just such a cool experience to witness these incredible athletes. I mean, these are people that they went 18 hours. They swam, they ran, they bike rode. I mean, like, I was astonished. And I'm getting to the food part, but I say all that because it was really, really hard for us to get reservations when we were in Nice. And so we found a couple of nice places that the hotel concierge was able to kind of point us to. They were still in a little bit more of the touristy area. We didn't do any Michelin star. We didn't do any of that kind of really, really special stuff relative to you know, when we were in Nice or Cannes. We did go to this one really cool winery, and the name escapes me right now, which is really frustrating. I'll include it in the show notes. But they had a little Airstream food truck, and it was just so incredibly wonderful. We're sitting at this vineyard in southern France. We got a bottle of rosé. We got a very nice lunch. I think my daughter had some of the best fried chicken nuggets that she had in the entire trip, and far better than what you can find in some of the common places here. And we're literally just sitting overlooking the vineyard. And so, I mean, I think I'm trying to think. I think my wife had a poke bowl that she really enjoyed. Just, you know, kind of a unique.
You know, traditional French food, poke bowl.
You'd be amazed at how much poke they had.
No, like, I'm not surprised at all. I'm not surprised at all. But at the same time, you know, it reminds me again. We do live in a globalist world, right? You know, where some things, you know, they do seem to transcend borders.
They do. They do. And then there are some things that transcend borders that make it feel more like a globo hobo or what did we call it?
You're channeling the globos, huh?
Yes.
The global hobos.
So from an eating perspective, it was either kind of meh and lackluster, or it was an experience that we really sought out. And so we really sought out that Airstream in southern France. We sought out a really unique experience, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts. And offline, probably far more offline than you ever want to admit, about how my focus of late has been really trying to get more unique experiences. And you know, it's probably infused by the fact of watching Eugene Levy on The Reluctant Traveler, back to the days of Anthony Bourdain or Stanley Tucci, and kind of those unique experiences. Well, my friend, thanks to Nick Reyes, who we had on a few episodes ago, I found something very close to the dream. We went to a little place about an hour and a half north of Genoa in Italy, called Acqua Terme, a beautiful little town. It's a really cool little wine area. We didn't get the chance to do any of the wineries. I should have reached out to the owner where we had the dinner, and she could have coordinated all that. Ariella was just absolutely awesome. We did a pizza making experience. And so they have a little apartment that they do for like Airbnb as well. They do tours. They do pasta for lunches. And so they've got a family. It's a husband, wife, and I think they've got four kids. And they essentially do a pizza making experience. It cost a bunch. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. I think it was a little bit below $300 for four of us, including my daughter. I think we had to pay full price for her. But they sort of did something that sort of made it more interesting, right? Originally, we were the only ones that were going to be there. And so the husband is, I think, Norwegian, somewhere Nordic. And they had neighbors that had kind of moved in to town just I guess for the summer. They moved down that were also Norwegian or Nordic. And so they had another family with two kids. And I'm pretty convinced that we paid for the whole like three families worth of meals, but it made it more of a collective kind of cultural experience because we were able to chat with the other guests that were Norwegian, able to chat with the husband and wife, and they had lived in Bermuda, so we had that connection to be able to chat about since my wife and I had been there for our honeymoon, and I'd been to Bermuda more times than most other countries. And so like, you know, we had a lot to connect on, and we had the ability to also make this just wonderful pizza. Some of the best pizza the best pizza I've ever had was at this place. And probably because I had a chance, you know, a piece in making it. They served rosé, sparkling rosé that was literally made 10 kilometers away. They served a nice white wine and red wine over dinner that was 5 kilometers away. We're overlooking just gorgeous vineyards and just a gorgeous countryside. And it was like that experience that you see in like in a Stanley Tucci episode or a Eugene Levy episode, and sitting at like the kind of family style table and everything. It was all
so hyper local sounds like is a good term for it. And
oh yeah.
And it sounds like you just had an extremely, what do you call it? Curated meal, you know, is what it sounded like.
It was. I mean, it was just such a cool experience. I mean, literally, we were on a one-way, we were on a single lane road just to get to this place. I'm not going to say that everything you find on Eat With, that's the website, Eat With, WITH, is going to be like this. But I just have to give absolute kudos to Nick for sharing that, because that just was such an incredible experience. And then the other notable experience, we had a private tour, just the four of us, at a Parma factory Parmadary, just south of Parma, Italy. And so we saw the whole process of how they make the make Parmesan Reggiano cheese through each stage.
And I'm so jealous.
Oh God! And we got to taste. I think it was 12 or 18 months, 24 months, and 36 months old. And then they threw in an extra. They gave us ricotta with some local honey. Mm-hmm. I've never had something so scrumptious than ricotta with honey. Like, I never would have thought ricotta, cheese, and honey would be, I mean, it was just incredible. Like, it was one of those mind-blowing things.
Yeah, no, it sounds wonderful. I mean, again, I've definitely had my share of Parmesan Reggiano, and to be able to go to the source, it's like you're going to the cheese mecca there.
Oh yeah, and the interesting thing is they've got like X number of dairies, and they're limited to certain amounts, right? So they're limited. The one we were at, they're trying to get up to 12 wheels a day. They're just at they're just at 10 now, but they're going to try to add another vat. And we watched them do the mixing. We saw the owner himself doing the mixing and all that other stuff, which was interesting. And then just to close off the food, something I didn't realize, and I don't think we noticed when we were in Venice or previously in Rome, is they do this aperitivo thing. And when we were at the Duomo in Milan, we go up. So there's a handle on Twitter that we follow. They're friends. We've caught up with them in Chile and a number of other places. Pat and Mike. The handle is Pat Mike L, as in Lima. They had shared with us this department store just to the side of the Duomo in Milan. You go up to the top floor, and they have a bunch of restaurants. And so we went to this one restaurant, and I'll include it in the show notes. And they do this aperitivo and a drink. And let's say it's 15 euro, and you're literally, six, seven floors up, looking at the Duomo, being able to observe the beauty of all that workmanship. And they bring you some focaccia, some burrata, which was just amazing, and a glass of Prosecco or gin and tonic, whatever you want to drink. And we found that aperitivo, while it varied across all the cities that we were in Italy, usually really took the edge off, as you're trying to make it to a dinner at, after 8 o'clock at night.
How very European of you.
I mean, when you're there for 18 days, you kind of have to adapt.
You got to do as the Romans do, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
But, I like that tip a lot. I definitely am one that in some cases do seek out department stores in foreign countries. And yeah, don't knock the dining in some of them, especially in places like Europe and Asia and other places where, some of those food options are among the best in the city. I wouldn't necessarily go to Macy's and seek out a restaurant, but in some of these other countries, this is probably a very smart thing to do.
And this is not the first time we've done it, but this was definitely probably the best view we've ever had.
Well, I feel like we've really covered a lot of the European lifestyle, and I feel like we got a good sense of kind of some of the highlights of those experiences that you were looking for. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a summary of like how you felt about the Riviera? I mean, I think one of the things that kind of strikes me is, especially for those who haven't been, what were your thoughts about the different communities there? What were some of your favorites, and which were some of the ones you could skip?
So I think Nice is one of those that I can't wait to go back to, partially because I think that Iron Man was just such a cool experience, and some of the play parks were just so good. But it's very walkable, so walkable. So much of the Riviera, the French Riviera, is just so flat and walkable, and we love to walk, we love to people watch. Nice didn't have great beaches. They literally have very rocky beaches, to the point where some of the beach clubs had like ropes that you kind of grabbed to be able to walk up on like a little bit of a carpety thing to be able to get to your lounger. I mean, because it's literally you're walking on rocks. So had the most beautiful water, but not the best beach. Cannes, we really, really loved. Very walkable, a little bit of construction that they had going on because it was, after their big Cannes, film festival and everything. So I guess they were trying to just, get a little bit of construction going in. The beach club for the Hotel Martinez was was not fully functional when we were there. However, just, I mean, literally across the street from the Hotel Martinez, you had the beach club a little bit to the right, and then you had a public beach to the left. And so we actually spent time in the public beach, and that was just wonderful. Just such a beautiful area Cannes was. This Fréjus, Saint-Raphaël, a little bit of a weird little kind of, you know, French, you know, purely French touristy area. We went to Saint-Tropez, which is well known as one of those, you know, lots of yachts and everything. We got to see a yacht dock, which was a lot of fun, seeing how like all the different crews around. So you've got the crews on each of the yachts that it's going in between, and the crew and the yacht that's coming in, and they've got the fenders and everything. It's just, it's a very interesting choreography to watch.
That sounds like the boat geek was geeking out.
Oh, I was totally geeking out. Totally, totally geeking out. And then we also got to a number of wineries. We got to the Chateau Minuti over near Saint-Tropez, which was wonderful, wonderful rosé. We went to that chateau that I will put in the show notes that has the Airstream trailer food truck, which again, an amazing experience and just one of those sorts of very relaxed things that like we were searching for. And then we also went to Chateau Rosaline, which is got a little bit of a medieval chapel and wonderful wine. Wonderful wine.
So I'm hearing a lot of France, but you know, does that discount the Italy, or is it still coming?
It's still coming. It's still coming. So Chateau Rosaline has an interesting uniqueness to it. There is a chapel, and there is an actual mummified body of, I think it's Saint Rosaline, and you can literally see the mummified body there. And then they have some beautiful, beautiful alfresco artwork on the walls that they that they unearthed after doing renovations. But you know, you don't really expect to see a mummified body. And so that was interesting. And like I said, the wine was good. They do steel barrel and oak barrel. And when you do a tasting, you can tell the difference. And I suppose you can always tell the difference, but it's just interesting to taste the difference in a rosé. Moving to Italy, Genoa, we found was interesting. Very, very altitudinally engaging, I'll say. We did like a little
a very
like,
vertical city or something. Is that
yeah,
what that
yeah, vertical city. Yes, yes. So we did seek out one of the Stanley Tucci places for some focaccia, which was wonderful. We did like a nice little like kids interactive area near the aquarium. So needless to say, though, they had a wonderful road and they did have an elevator, which we found our last day there. And I was like, oh, I wish I'd have known this, because that was one place where my mother-in-law was just sort of somewhat limited. We were only there for 3 nights. And so we only had really one day to explore. And then the other day we had gone up to Acqua Terme, which was a beautiful little sleepy town. I mean, I say sleepy, I don't want to offend anybody, but it was a small little town. They had an aquifer. We didn't see the aquifer. We went around looking for it. We found a nice little play yard, a play park that our daughter played in with other kids and had a nice bite to eat, and then went to our little pizza thing. Parma was a really fun little city. If the hotel had been better, we probably would have stayed 2 nights, but just a very, very walkable, fun little college town. I mean, I guess I didn't think of a city with the, you know, with the reputation of the home of Parmesan Reggiano cheese being a college town, but it really was. And it was vibrant and it had just that kind of nice feel and very, very walkable, very flat and very walkable. And then Milan, we just love Milan. We've always loved Milan. The Hyatt Centric is in the business area. So some of the restaurants really close by closed down on the weekends, which was a little bit disappointing. So we had some nice restaurants on Friday night, and then Saturday night they were all closed. So we didn't get to try out a couple of places that we wanted to see. We also ran into an interesting challenge in Milan. Our big touring day was Saturday, I think it was the 29th of June. And that happened to be the day that the Gay Pride Festival and Gay Pride Parade was going on. And they sort of circle I guess there's a fairly circular path that they take that ended up being between us and the Duomo. And so we tried to take an Uber And the Uber was supposed to be like 20 euros. It took us an hour with the Uber. He was getting turned around every which way. And so they ended up like changing it to like 100 euros. And I was like, if I knew it was going to be that, I wouldn't have taken it. And I thankfully put a little complaint in, not a problem with the driver, just, you know. And I feel bad for the driver, but like, you know, Uber should have the,
They'd have the intelligence to look at the street and realize, you know, hey, this is a little abnormal here. We're not going to be able to charge you the normal price.
Exactly. And so since they didn't, you know, they made it right, but definitely made it for an interesting experience. I mean, those types of festivals just bring out a lot of people, and it's really cool to see. It's just less cool when you really actually need an Uber to be able to get you there versus like if it was just just my wife and I and daughter, we probably would have just walked all of it. But we really had to take that Uber. We ended up taking the Metro back, which actually worked out all right. I probably should have just done that the first time. But that's one area that I have a blind spot on.
Well, you're also with your mother-in-law, you know, and by the way, you know, just because you have the thought to use mass transit doesn't mean that mass transit always is the option. I mean, I was fully ready to take mass transit from Heathrow Airport to London. And of course, the Jubilee line went down exactly when I wanted to use it. We had to completely change our plans for that too. So it happens. You just have to be adaptable, I think. But you know what I'm hearing is I'm hearing a tale of two cities or two countries here. It seems like a very, very seaside-esque, you know, French vacation and a very much more land-focused Italian vacation.
And it really was that way. I mean, even though Genoa is on the water, it didn't feel at all on the water. I mean, it literally just felt like another city that just happened to have a port, for lack of a better way of saying it. And maybe that was better that way. I mean, I of course want to make it to the Amalfi Coast and down further. And I mean, there's a lot of Italy that we still have to see. So I don't want to judge it just based on kind of what we experienced. But I'm happy to have gotten to Genoa, just knowing the history of Genoa. I mean, it's very well known for the, I suppose it's named known for their salami. They're known for their focaccia.
Or in their ham.
The ham. Pesto. Did you know that pesto has tree nuts in it?
Pine nuts.
Yeah, yes. I can't eat pine nuts.
Pignolas.
So I was very disappointed when I learned that pesto had pine nuts to the home of pesto.
Yes.
But needless to say, everybody else was able to have pesto and they all enjoyed it. And I just sort of looked down and just kind of whimpered a bit and went on with my.
We might be able to, you know, you might be able to substitute something else. And you're not allergic to all nuts, right? Just pine nuts and hazelnuts.
Pine nuts, hazelnuts, tree nuts.
Walnuts too.
No, walnuts I can do.
Oh,
walnuts.
Yeah, you know, you might want to substitute a different nut or something when you make your own homemade pesto or something.
Yeah, but I wanted to have the original, so I missed out.
You want to have the authentico, you know, version, right?
Yeah. But one day, if they ever figure out something for that. But yeah, it really felt like Italy was more city, you know, land and city and mountains. And France was just much more coastal and just absolutely gorgeous.
It just seems like they have those lovely seaside promenades, you know, like you mentioned all the kind of the flatness and to be able to do, you know, kind of what, you know, what we are used to doing in a beach town, which is later walk the boardwalk or, you know, be able to do that seaside stroll, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, you've been teasing it a couple of times. So what exactly happened at this Accor hotel that was has made your infamous five worst ever list of hotels? What exactly happened there?
So this Accor hotel was advertised as a 4 or 5 star hotel. The location was absolutely wonderful. I will totally give it credit on the location just outside of the old town. I booked it non-refundable through American Express. It was not even a hotel collection or fine hotels and resorts. I needed somewhere to book it through. And we get there and this hotel was probably a wonderful hotel 40 or 50 years ago. The mattresses didn't seem like they had been updated in 40 years. All the accoutrements, the furnishing and everything literally looked like it was 30 to 40 years since they had last had some sort of an update. apparently because you book it, because I booked it through American Express, because I mean, they did have a lower rate. They saw it as Expedia, so I couldn't even get any points. Not that I have much use for Accor points right now, but overall, just the hotel really was one of those really, really old feeling. I mean, the smell of the hotel, they couldn't get the air conditioning down. It just was one of those things where we had gotten out of this apartment. The apartment wasn't amazing by any means, but it was comfortable. And this place, like none of us could get a good night's sleep in the one night that we were there. So the next morning we said, you know what? We're just leaving. We're going to give up the second night. Don't charge us for the parking. And we'll go our way, you go your way, and we're just never going to
stay. Was this an Accor branded? Like, what was the actual brand of the hotel? Was it an Ibis or was it a what are those brands that they have out there?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask this, and I've got a
you have a mental block. Apparently, you're compartmentalizing.
I do have a mental block. It is the Mercure.
Parma. Oh, okay.
It is a Mercure or Mercure Parma, yeah, okay. Centro Stendhal.
Sounds like a place where the Griswolds would stay, right?
I don't know, but if you look at the website, I mean, they have nice fluffy pillows on top of the beds. These pillows were sadder. These pillows were sadder than like Linus's pillow. I mean, everything about this hotel, like the pictures made it look, it's almost like the pictures just like inflated air into everything, mm-hmm. make it look a little bit more airy, more fluffy, more modern. And
I guess the AI did a really good job of enhancing the photos.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. Unfortunately. So that was really the only hotel that really let us down. That was the only lodging that let us down. And thankfully, because we've got all the Hyatt points and everything, when we got in there, we went to dinner. And over dinner, I presented a pivot, and the family agreed with the pivot. We said we were going to get up. We're going to get a nice little breakfast on the way. We're going to go to the Parma Parma Dairy, do the tour, and then we're just going to go straight up to Milan. And I was able to book us in the Hyatt Centric for an extra night, and by the time we got to the Hyatt Centric, the AC was blasting in the rooms. Everybody was happy. This was one of those pivots that was just the exact right call, and was able to drop the car off a little early and save a little bit there to kind of recover a little bit of the loss on the hotel.
Yeah, gotta love, you know, good hotel AC, especially in the summertime. Can't beat it. And honestly, it can make or break a stay.
It can. And the bedding of the Hyatt Centric was absolutely wonderful. It felt very Asian focused. And I noticed the clientele seemed to be, I would say, noticeably Asian, like not exclusively Asian, but there was definitely a fair bit of Asians at that hotel.
You know, they're known to travel.
Asians. Yeah, no. I'm not complaining. But it felt like they were really catering to that demographic. And I happen to like Asian hotels anyway. So like it worked out really well.
You know, Hyatt is a lot stronger in Asia than it is in Europe.
They absolutely are.
I wouldn't be surprised if their brand equity in that region is kind of extending to those vacationing Asians that know and love the brand because of, you know, hotels in Japan and Taiwan and Korea and everywhere else.
Well, and the fact that a hotel, while catering to that demographic, sort of emulates some of their counterparts in Asia. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of what it felt like with the bedding and with some of the accoutrements. I would recommend it. It's in a business area. It's not, that part's not amazing. It's about a 10-minute walk from the main train station, and probably about a 20-minute walk más o menos to the Duomo. Park Hyatt's great as well. Love the Park Hyatt, but it's more than twice the price. And I realize we're getting a little bit long here, but I wanted to share a couple of kind of experiences and then some goofs and gaffs. So we drove, we rented a car. It was a Skoda SUV hatchback. I was able to somehow get an upgrade. I don't know how I did it other than the fact that the previous car that they gave me just didn't seem to, they sort of looked at me and they're like, yeah, you need something bigger. And I'm like, okay, fine. you know, I'll go with it. Turns out that the car had some sort of weird random thing going on. We didn't notice it at the time. We had that bag. Remember that bag, the blue bag that we bought in Singapore? And I realize this is weird for our listeners, but that Bausch & Lomb, was it Bausch & Lomb?
Oh, you mean the Longchamp bag?
Longchamp. Yes, Longchamp.
Yeah. You got me confused. I heard Bausch & Lomb and I'm thinking contact lenses? What?
Longchamp, Bausch & Lomb. I mean, it's close.
I don't know. Anyway.
So we had this Longchamp bag and we had thrown, because we're maximizers, I'll say, we had thrown some drinks in the bag from the lounge flying out of Nice into Milan. And so we had all these drinks in the bag and we threw whatever like the waters that the Park Hyatt Milan had, not trying to be cheap, but just trying to be efficient. And my wife puts the bag down by her feet. And when we pull the bag out at some random point, I guess when we got back to France, it's all wet on the bottom. And she's like, oh, that's weird. Must have just been condensate. And we didn't think anything of it. Well, we get back into the car a couple of days later and my mother-in-law is with us. And she's like, there's a puddle. There's like a pool in the back here in like the backseat passenger side footwell. To the point where it's like over her feet, like in her shoes. And I'm like, what on earth happened here? Like, we didn't notice this. And then my wife notices, she's like, yeah, it's actually pretty wet up here. And I'm like, it's all dry here. I didn't, you know, so we know, we have no idea what happened to the car, right? Like, we noticed this after we left the Cannes, the Hotel Martinez in Cannes.
Was it just like a leak or something? Or did they leave a window open maybe?
We don't know. My assumption is that like the window was left open or something. I don't know if it was the Hotel Martinez in Cannes that did it, or if this was what we got like from the rental car and we just didn't, or the rental facility in Milan, we just didn't notice it because we didn't have somebody sitting in the back. But that was a very unique experience that we did not expect, to the point where we were literally with a little cup bailing water out. It was that much water. So we found like a little hill and you know, to get it to one side. At one point my mother-in-law is scooping the water out by the cupful, which is kind of a weird thing. So no idea what happened there. They didn't end up penalizing us at all. Water under the bridge, or I suppose under the seat. There,
the dad jokes are not getting any better, by the way.
Yeah, I know. We're getting a little long in the tooth here. So, driving in France, the French are more aggressive, surprisingly so, and so we got flipped off a few times. Not entirely sure why.
Stupid Americans.
Yes, exactly. In Italy, it was literally the tale of two cities, or the tale of two countries. Driving from Milan back to France. No problems, no traffic. Everybody was really courteous. Everything was fine. It took us 6 hours to drive from Cannes to Genoa, which should have only been about a two and a half hour drive. And that was because of numerous accidents, construction that got us down to, you know, sharing tunnels. At one point, because of an accident, we were all stopped for like good 30 minutes. Then we get going. And we go to two lanes, then we go back to one lane, and there's this Polish truck that is literally blocking both lanes. Like, some people were going out to a rest stop and then coming back in like a couple hundred meters ahead. And people behind me are beeping at me, and I'm like, well, I'm in one lane. This Polish driver is in both lanes, and then I get a big truck to my right in, you know, the right lane. And I try to go past the Polish truck, and he blocks me. And then he opens his door and he's like, you know, he flips me whatever motion he flipped me. In New York, I'd call it the bird. And so we end up finally getting going and a little bit of my New Yorker came out. Now, for our listeners, I don't know if I've talked too much about a little bit of my New York heritage, but I have driven in Lower Manhattan. I've driven in Thailand. I've driven in a fair amount of places. And so here we are, we're merging. As we're entering a tunnel, the Polish truck is in front of me. I've got a truck next to me, and his grill is a little bit ahead and a little bit behind my right side view mirror. And I'm of the opinion that I'm going to go behind this Polish truck and the truck in the right lane is going to just back off. Everybody else in the car was wondering whether or not I was going to lose the side view mirror. At one point, my wife said that she closed her eyes. The truck in the right lane relented. It was one of those moments where I suppose I got to learn a little bit more about how the Italians drive. But largely, Italians drive wonderfully. I was astonished driving downtown Milan and everything. They don't, you know, blinkers and lanes or suggestions, but everybody just avoids everybody. And it's actually, you know, there's not a lot of beeping or horns or no expletives. It's just, Italy was a wonderful country to drive in other than that one experience with the trucks.
So, like, would you say that you would do it again? Would you, I mean, was renting the car the right decision, or would a different mode of transportation made more sense?
I think it was absolutely the right decision. And the only thing I would have done differently is I would have left a whole lot earlier out of Cannes.
Got it.
I think we left at like noon or 1 o'clock, and I think we just caught with everything. Had we left at like 10, we would have been fine.
Sounds like what would happen to you if you left Ocean City around noon or 1 o'clock. You'd probably be in just about the same amount of delay.
Yeah. No. I totally agree with that. I don't know. I think these truck drivers were just pissed and unhappy, and it was a Sunday, and why were they working on a Sunday? And I think people just had a bad day, but I just thought it was interesting because sometimes I push my luck, and this was one of those where I was just pigheaded, and you know, I sometimes we got to just accept that.
Well, I mean, you know, you get a little bit of road rage, you know, when a truck is kind of doing what it's not supposed to do.
I didn't really treat it as road rage, as the zipper works in a particular way, and this is how I'm going to work it because you blocked me, and so yeah, I don't know. Nobody followed me. There was nothing. There was no Russell Crowe experience afterwards. So, I mean, all's well that ends well.
That's right. But it's good to know that, you know, the Italians, I guess, are a little bit more kind when it comes to their fellow drivers than maybe the French.
Oh, and the tolls. There are a lot of tolls.
Oh, in Italy, huh?
Yeah, it felt like, so the Autostrada is convenient because you just take a ticket, just like the Turnpike. And then you pay like 34 euros when you finally get off.
Oh, God. That's some sticker shock. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's not an insane. Well,
mind you, the Turnpike isn't exactly isn't really cheap either. So you could probably get some sticker shock running the entire Turnpike as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And then in France, instead of the tickets, you just stopped and tapped your card. The convenient thing is that you just literally tap your, you know, tap
in contactless. Card. Contactless.
Yes, contactless card. Which I mm-hmm. found to be very convenient. I mean, I almost preferred that compared to having to do like some sort of easy pass thing where the rental car company is going to figure out a way to charge you $10 a day for something that you're paying a toll for like $2 or €2.
Yeah, tolls make me so, just infuriate me, especially in the rental car experience, you know, just having those, all those different transceivers and, you know, what they end up charging you for your 50-cent toll.
Yeah. Overall, though, I was very impressed with the ease of the rental car experience. It was not as easy as National. I did through National, by the way, but they didn't have Emerald Isle or anything else. You know, you had to go to the counter, then you had to go to another counter. But it wasn't nearly as involved as I had feared it would be. It was still more involved than like if you went to Avis or something where you didn't have like the go right to your car thing. But yeah, I kept fearing that there was going to be a gotcha, and it never came. And so all in all, I would rent a car again. I would drive in Italy again. I would drive in France again. There are a lot of the things that we tried differently in this trip. I'd do it again because it all just worked out so well.
So I guess we heard a lot about your land travels. Of course, you did still have to cross an ocean, right, to get back home. And you were able to fly, I guess, a European air carrier that I'm not that familiar with, actually.
Oh, you're not familiar with Swiss?
I have never flown Swiss.
I did not know that.
Nope, never have.
So Swiss only recently added Dulles to their network. And that made, until this ITA tie-up with Lufthansa Group goes final, that made Swiss the last of the Lufthansa Group long-haul, I suppose, brands to connect to Dulles. And so We were really excited with that one.
I don't know. Idleweiss, you know, I don't think we have Idleweiss.
Oh man, you proved me wrong. Damn.
Mind you, they're typically to tourist destinations, not so much, you know,
well, a national capital. But if you're going to go that way, what's the other Lufthansa one?
Eurowings, but they don't typically do transatlantic.
Doesn't Eurowings do Tampa Bay?
Does Eurowings go to Tampa? Hmm. Well, there you go. There's that. That's one more brand.
Okay. Okay. The major premium brands.
The main line flag carrier brands.
Yeah. So needless to say, we were excited to see Swiss. Ironically enough, we had flown, the last time we flew Swiss was when we flew from Beijing to Zurich with my mother-in-law. So my mother-in-law's flown almost as many Swiss flights as my wife and I. And so we were really excited about that. As an aside, I have been seeing a lot of middling opening of the Swiss space because I think a lot of people aren't looking at a flight out of Zurich to Dulles. So that might be an opportunity going forward. We got four seats, I think, a month or 2 months out of our trip. So sometime in May or April, we were able to get four seats straight away. I made a gaffe, though, booking through Air Canada. I chose our seats, and I didn't realize it until I was looking at the bill later after it was not changeable. I paid an egregious amount to book two throne seats. I should have just not bothered to book any seats at all, in hindsight. The throne was nice on the, I think it was A330.
What did they charge? What exorbitant fee were you charged?
I think for the two, I paid like $500.
Oh, each or for both?
I think it was five or 540 for all, for both. Okay. And I'm not very happy about that. It was hard for me to say that. I was really frustrated with myself after I noticed it. I think, in hindsight,
sounds like a surprise fuel surcharge. You know, it's like you picked up the card from Monopoly and chances pay additional fuel surcharge. YQ.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. I mean, I had booked it literally on my phone. Like, we were out somewhere and I was like, oh, I see the space. I got to grab it now. And I just did it. And sometimes when you just kind of act quick, it just doesn't go the way you want it. But you know what? Everything worked out. And by the time I noticed it, I was like, card's already paid off, all that other stuff. You feel like you got less value. But the reality is the trip was incredible. Everybody was very happy. And everybody was really happy with their seats on the way home, too. So all's well that ends well, I guess is what I'd say. The onboard product for Swiss is pretty good. I like it. The food's good. They had a very nice wine, I thought. Nothing amazing on the champagne or bubble side, but reasonable enough. And I think the food was pretty good. Not as good as our last flight. We flew Beijing to Zurich. I want to say it was like in 2012 or 2013. And I had one of the best steaks I've ever had on a plane in any cabin.
So would you say that it's superior to Austrian? Or it seemed like it would be better than Lufthansa's standard business class, at least from a hard product standpoint.
Yeah, I liked it better than Lufthansa. I think the wines were better on Lufthansa than Swiss. I still think Austrian has a better meal product. And the onboard chef and the coffee menu, I think just sets Austrian aside, which is ironic because Austrian doesn't have a first-class cabin and Swiss does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just, that's perplexing to me because I expected Swiss to be so much better. And if I gauged it on like 10 years ago, then I would say Swiss best business out of the four, but I kind of put it neck and neck with Austrian.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And you know, it wouldn't surprise me completely because, you know, not having been to Austria or Vienna or flown Austrian either, I guess I'm rather behind on my Lufthansa group carriers. I don't think I've flown Brussels Air either, but for that matter. But in any case.
We're going to have to add some of those to the list, my friend. The interesting thing about the Swiss loungers, so I'm a little bit spoiled, right? The Lufthansa loungers.
No, really? Are you spoiled?
Quiet you. So the Lufthansa lounges, if you have an American Express Platinum card, you can get into like the next nicer level, right? So like you go into the, if you're in business class, instead of the business class, you go to the Senator's Lounge. And with the Swiss lounges, you don't really have that choice. I don't even know if they have the next up, but when we've flown Swiss in economy, we've not been able to get into any lounge. But they do have an arrivals lounge, which was kind of funny. So we went to the arrivals lounge before we went to the B Skydeck. And they have this little thing that says, like, hit the call button, and then, like, the door will open, all this other stuff, right? Well, I'm here to tell you that we hit the call button for a good 90 seconds and nobody answered. So finally, I just said, you know what? I really want to see what's on the other side of this door. And so I did like a Captain America where I just opened the door. It was like one of those sliding doors. And so I just like, you know, separated the doors. And after a certain point, they just naturally opened. We walked in, stepped into the elevator, walked up, showed our boarding passes, and no one was the wiser. But it was definitely a weird experience to have to like literally physically separate the doors to just get in. They did have ice cream. That's the other thing. The lounges have Mövenpick ice cream.
Oh, Mövenpick ice cream. That is very, very good stuff.
There were multiple Mövenpicks that were enjoyed during that layover. I will say that.
So, you know, the one thing that I, you know, since we're doing such a great tour of all these LH Group places, you know, I did notice there's one place that LH Group does not fly.
Oh, where is this?
Melbourne.
You're right. That's the interesting thing. No LH Group seems to fly to the Australian continent, let alone Melbourne itself.
Drink time.
That is the one thing, like, I had wanted to try to figure out multiple times how I could, like, route. Like, they don't have a kangaroo route at all.
Yeah, they really don't. You know, I guess the Germans didn't really, the Germanic peoples didn't actually colonize that part of the world.
Now I have to go back and look to see if Air France or KLM have that route or not. I mean, I know they do Fifth Freedom from Singapore to Denpasar, Bali, but I don't think they get down to Australia either.
Yeah, they may not, but they get close. I mean, they definitely get to Singapore. And of course, you know, you realize that the French Polynesia has some routing there as well.
Yeah, how do they do? But they do that primarily through LAX, right?
I believe so. Or at least they did at one point. I haven't really kept up on my Fifth Freedom flights, but yes.
Well, I wonder whether Qantas doing that Perth to Paris is going to create a little bit of a desire for competition, or, you know, a little desire for Air France to try to go there. I think I was listening to the Air France CEO on the Air Show podcast this morning from like way back when they were at the IATA general meeting in Dubai. And he was saying something to the effect of they only have 2 14-hour or longer routes in the Air France KLM group.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's surprising. I guess I didn't think about it, that they're really not into the ultra long haul.
Yeah, it was interesting because they were talking about what aircraft they're looking at, and I think they're taking on 90 or 99 A350s. And when asked about the 777-9X, they're sort of like, well, we only have 2 14-hour routes, I should say. Yeah, apparently that CEO, and I don't know the name off the top of my head, was the former, I think, Air Canada CEO. So worked on both sides of the Atlantic.
Ben? Is his first name Ben or something like that? I'm trying to remember.
It's either Ben or Brian. It's okay. A B. It's definitely a B.
Yeah, it's definitely a B. But, you know, there are those French overseas territories that, you know, they don't serve nonstop. And, of course, they don't currently have those 14-hour flights. They could obviously, you know, convert some of these flights that need to stop in other places. Some of these Fifth Freedoms exist clearly because they couldn't do a nonstop. But even though with modern-day planes, it's very possible for them to kind of eliminate a stop if they wanted to.
Yeah, that's true. I think the interesting thing, I think Ben Smith, it's Ben Smith, by the way.
Yes, yes.
Had said was that I guess Paris has the most O&D of any, or most tourist focus. Like most people want to go to Paris or France in general. Mm-hmm. They get something like 100,000. Is it 100,000 a year?
That's too low.
Yeah, maybe it's a million or 10 million or something. I'll have to go back to that podcast. The Air Show podcast, by the way, if anybody hasn't listened and is any bit of an air, an AV geek, Focus. It's very, very good. It's got Cranky Flyer. It's got, and we probably talked about this in previous episodes, it's got John Ostrower and Brian Summers, and they bring an interesting industry view, and they're really geared toward industry, which is kind of fun for I think me, and I don't know if you've listened to it yourself.
I kind of needed to, just because you just kind of name drop this podcast every other episode or so, but so I did finally listen to it. It is a very interesting podcast, and it does provide that industry perspective, which is nice, because I'll be honest, we enjoy doing a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. What would we do as CEO of XYZ airline all the time? We have our opinions. And sometimes it's not that different, I feel like we could go on that show and probably hold our own. But yeah, but that just closing the loop on that. Yeah, it would be interesting to see Air France at KLM Group start serving some of their far-flung former colonial assets nonstop. Because, in many cases, that's where you see a lot of these interesting Fifth Freedoms all over the world, right? It's because they are not doing nonstop Amsterdam to Bali, or nonstop Papeete to Charles de Gaulle, or nonstop New Caledonia, Noumea to Charles de Gaulle.
And it also opens up opportunities for those of us that can read award charts.
especially for those places that are very close to Australia, which, hopefully, I don't know what the political unrest situation is in New Caledonia these days, but that is not very far flung from the Australian shore.
Yeah, and not to further go on that tangent, but I'm seeing a lot of Fiji one or two seaters coming up every so often as I continue to look for that Australia flight to, or Australia trip. So just sharing that for those that might be interested. Well, I think we've gone on a couple of tangents. I think we covered a whole lot.
18 days worth, apparently.
It feels like 24 days by when you factor in the tangents here.
Yes.
Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get even more access to in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.